10 months after his wife's funeral, I was back in Yorba Linda to cover his. Richard Nixon was the first U.S. president I interviewed, and he played an important role in my early career. He had always been considerate toward me. His death marked the end of a painful era for America, but it also touched me in a personal way and made me sad. End of my digression on Nixon. Back to the 1970s and another death that really did change my life. In April 1974, I was in California when the call came from New York. Frank McGee was dead at 52. Frank dead? I couldn't believe it. We all thought he was sick, but we had no idea how ill he'd been. It turned out that he'd had bone cancer. He must have been in great pain, but he did the program almost every morning until the day he died, and never said a word about it to any of us. I immediately flew back to New York and was on Today the very next day. We were all in shock, as were our viewers. I received hundreds of letters of sympathy from people all over the country, a testament to the seemingly pleasant and totally false relationship I'd had with Frank. Frank's wife and his children were at his funeral. Mammy was nowhere in sight. Shortly after everyone returned to the office, the drama deepened. Mammy and Stuart Schulberg got into a fight, and he fired her. Though he later apologized and offered to help her transfer to another department at NBC, Mammy decided to sue NBC for racial discrimination. The situation created a terrible rift on the show, pitting Mammy's supporters and friends against Schulberg and the more senior members on the program. In the end, the Office of Equal Employment Opportunity dismissed her complaint of racism. Mammy had left Today by then to work elsewhere at NBC, and things calmed down. None of this, not even the lawsuit, ever got into the papers. After Frank's death, NBC immediately embarked on a search for a new male host for Today. Many names were flung about, including NBC outsiders like Dick Cavett and Bill Moyers, and NBC News insiders like Tom Brokaw, Tom Snyder, Garrick Utley, and Jim Hartz. NBC decided on Hartz, a pleasant and popular local newscaster. They seemed to want someone easy and uncontroversial. There had been enough drama in the country and on the Today Show. But just before the announcement was due to be made, Lee Stevens called the top guys at NBC and said, "Oh, fellows, by the way, there's just one little thing." He reminded them of the contract he had negotiated with them. "In case Frank McGee leaves the show," Lee pointed out, "Barbara is going to be a co-host." On April 22, 1974, NBC sent out a press release announcing my new position. "Barbara Walters will be co-host of the NBC Television Network's Today program from now on," read the release from Donald Meany, Vice President of Television News Programming. "This is the first time the program has had a co-host, and Today is now the only TV network news or public affairs program to have a female co-host." And so it was that I became the official co-host of the Today Show. 2 years later, I would leave Today. But from that moment to the present, every woman on the morning television shows on every network has been a co-host. This is, of course, not noted in the history books, but it was a very big step at the time. And all because Lee Stevens slipped a clause into my contract that no one at NBC thought they would ever have to act on. Fun and Games in Washington. Washington came alive after the president's resignation in August 1974. Genial Gerald Ford replaced gloomy Richard Nixon, and the whole city seemed to take a deep breath and relax. As was said then, it was the end of the national nightmare. There was an air of gaiety, of celebration and relief. Unlike today, when foreign nations' embassies are quite serious places with occasional staid dinners, the embassies in the Ford era seemed to vie with one another to be thought the most popular and exciting place to be. The parties were invaluable to me in terms of making personal contacts. Nothing is more important to a journalist than a phone book full of home phone numbers and a person on the other end who knows and likes you. So these were working parties for me as well as fun. The number one embassy when it came to extravagance and just plain enjoyment was the Iranian embassy, presided over by its flamboyant bachelor ambassador, Ardashir Zahedai. The Shah of Iran, in his early 20s, had entered an arranged marriage that lasted a short time but produced a daughter, Princess Shahnaz Pahlavi. Zahedai had been married to the princess. They too had a daughter and then later divorced. But the Shah maintained his friendship with his former son-in-law. The ambassador was an imposing figure, tall and dark, with a great head of hair, a prominent nose, a ready smile, and a glad hand for everyone. He was also smart, shrewd, and the Shah's most trusted advisor in the United States. No one knew if the Shah approved, but Zahedai believed in large parties with hundreds of guests, flowing champagne, mounds of fresh Iranian caviar, and a bulging buffet with every kind of treat from hummus to hamburgers. You could eat your fill, mingle and mix, or just stand around and watch. There was plenty to watch. There were belly dancers to clap to, musicians to listen to, bands to dance to, politicians to talk to, and movie stars to ogle. Elizabeth Taylor was a favorite guest. There were rumors that Miss Taylor and the ambassador were having an affair. But he never seemed to have a real girlfriend. As a matter of fact, when Farah Diba, the Empress of Iran, paid visits to New York, Zahedai asked me to be his date. He usually took over a small private room at 21 and invited a select group of dignitaries and friends. I had already met the Shahbanu, as she was called, and the ambassador could count on me to mind my manners and follow protocol. The next day, I would be the recipient of several pounds of caviar. NBC would not allow the members of its news department to accept gifts. No network news department allows it to this day, but caviar and candy, being perishable items, were allowed. Zahedai once sent me a Cartier watch for my birthday, which I not only returned to him, but wrote a letter explaining why. It was, by the way, a very pretty watch. I also sent a copy to Dick Wald, head of NBC News, and kept a copy for myself. This turned out to have been a very wise thing to do. Shortly after the Shah was overthrown in 1979, the new fundamentalist Islamic regime accused American reporters of being on the take. I was one of the reporters they publicly accused, mentioning a Cartier watch they had obviously found a record of in some file or other, but, aha, I had the letter, proving I had never accepted it. But all this was some years away from the swinging parties of the 70s given by the generous ambassador. Washington had another bachelor ambassador, Alejandro Orfila of Argentina, who had also been married and divorced. He supposedly owned a lot of houses and land back in his home country, and he too liked to have lavish parties, although not quite in the Zahedai League. Orfila was a serious man, as indeed were all the ambassadors. You didn't get dispatched as your country's chief diplomat to the most important post in the world if you were anything but first rate. I went to quite a few parties at the Argentine embassy and had a very pleasant dalliance with Ambassador Orfila. We went out several times, and I was startled when, out of the blue, he asked me to marry him. Was he kidding? I brushed off his proposal, if that's what it was, and we continued to be friends. Maybe he just wanted an American wife. Orfila went on to become the twice-elected Secretary General of the prestigious Organization of American States, OAS. We lost touch after he left Washington, but I've always remembered him fondly from that period of gaiety in the nation's capital. I was also seeing several men in New York. There was Alan Greenberg, known to his friends and colleagues as Ace, the brilliant banker who made the investment banking firm Bear Stearns the formidable institution it became. I had known Alan, I always called him Alan, ever since he came to New York from Oklahoma in the 1960s, and eventually became Ace. He was extremely smart and funny. Today he's happily married to Kathy, a charming lawyer, and is one of my closest and most trusted friends. Furthermore, he manages whatever money I have. I will always be grateful to have Alan in my life. I don't know what I would do without him. There was also a fascinating man named John Diebold, who wrote the visionary book Automation, which extended the meaning of automation beyond the car assembly lines in Detroit to business machines. He was a techie genius when it came to automating transactions and records in banks and healthcare. Don't ask me more. That's all I understood. His daughter went to the same school as Jackie, and we were introduced at a parents' conference. John was one of the most considerate men I'd ever met. Of every man I knew then, John was the warmest and sweetest to Jackie. He had imaginative taste. Jackie, Zell, and I had both a pre-Thanksgiving and early Christmas dinner at John's beautifully furnished apartment on the East River. Igodel was having dinner with her children. John had his wonderful cook make everything a little girl would like, from corn pudding and sweet potatoes with marshmallows to yummy banana splits for dessert. One Christmas, John gave Jackie a miniature horse farm with stables and 6 tiny horses with separate saddles. She was thrilled. Much better than the mouse house. Why am I going into all this? Because it was a very heady and happy time for me. I had never had those years in my early 20s and 30s, when one dated in a lighthearted way. I was too concerned with my family, trying to keep us all afloat, both emotionally and financially. Then, in my beginning years at NBC, it was work, work, work. It still was, but the rewards were greater, my status had grown, and I was no longer that serious girl who rarely smiled. Finally, there had been my marriage to Lee and the birth of our daughter. Now, in my early 40s, I was experiencing what I had never really known before. Fun and romances. Please understand, too, that all of these men were not in my life exactly at the same time, and some I saw more than others. Before you say enough already, let me speak of 2 more. Just before the Watergate hearings, I had gone to Los Angeles to visit my oldest and dearest friend, then and now, Joyce Ashley. Joyce was married to Ted Ashley, they later divorced, who headed Warner Brothers Pictures. They had a glorious home in Malibu right on the beach, and their neighbors were the actress Jennifer Jones and her hugely wealthy husband, Norton Simon, who had a magnificent art collection. He later gave it to an art museum he built in Pasadena, California, which bears his name. Jennifer was long past her movie career, but she was still a beautiful woman who, however, was so insecure about her looks that she changed clothes at least 3 times before any party she gave and always made sure the soles of her shoes were wiped clean so that they looked brand new. Anyway, in spite of all this, or maybe because of all this, I liked Jennifer a lot. She was fey and funny, generous and thoughtful. One night she invited Joyce, Ted, and me to dinner and introduced us to an extremely attractive man named Matthew Byrne, who was a federal judge. Matt was about as appealing a person as I have ever met. A gregarious bachelor, he seemed to have a million friends and was one of the most sought-after men in Los Angeles. However, coming from a very close family, he supported his mother, sister, and nephew, he had never shown any signs of wanting to marry. At first, Matt wasn't too crazy about me. He had become rather well known because he was the judge assigned to the famous 1973 trial of Daniel Ellsberg. Ellsberg had been accused of espionage, theft, and conspiracy by the government for leaking the secret Pentagon papers to the New York Times. For the first half hour we met, I badgered Byrne with questions about Ellsberg and the trial, when all he wanted to do was have a scotch and relax. He told me later he almost walked out. But I must have calmed down and done something right, because after that we went out almost every night that I was in Los Angeles. We had a lovely little romance, but never quite made it to the point of being deeply serious. I may have been, had Matt wanted it, but I can't recall his ever saying he loved me. Did he ever love anyone? Even after his mother died, he never married. He could have had an even more prestigious career, but he made one big mistake. During the Ellsberg trial, Matt had a supposedly secret meeting with one of Nixon's top aides, John Ehrlichman, to discuss the possibility of him being named head of the FBI. The meeting could have been construed as a bribe at worst and at best improper. When it was leaked, it destroyed all chances of the appointment. I discussed this meeting only once with Matt, who swore that the meeting was not about the FBI job, but he wouldn't say what it was about, so I don't really know what happened. But Matt remained on the bench for the next 30 years as a very well-thought-of federal judge. We stayed loosely in touch over the years, and I was very touched when, in the winter of 2006, I received a phone call from Matt's grown nephew informing me that his uncle was dying of lung disease and would love to hear from me. I called Matt, who was very weak, and we joked about past moments in our lives. Before I hung up, I said, "I love you, dear friend." Matt answered, "I love you too, dear friend." That's as close as we got to the L word. He died 2 weeks later. Now just one more gentleman caller, as playwright Tennessee Williams would call him. Toward the end of the Watergate impeachment hearings in 1974, I was in New York for a few days when some mutual friends introduced me to a man I had sure heard a lot about. His name was Charles Revson, and he was the multimillionaire founder and owner of Revlon Cosmetics, which at that time was the most successful cosmetic company on the planet. Revson had just divorced his third wife by having her brought to his office on her birthday. The story goes that she thought she was going to be given a big share of Revlon's stock as a present. Instead, Revson's lawyers handed her a letter advising her that her husband was filing suit for divorce. It was in all the papers and just added to his reputation as a brilliant but hardly sentimental tycoon. Revson was in his late 60s when I met him, divorced and rumored to be dating Lee Radziwill. So I was very surprised when friends who were in the perfume business and worked with Revson said he wanted to meet me. The things one remembers. It was summer. I was wearing a brand new yellow silk pantsuit. Pantsuits were rather avant-garde at that time, and I thought I looked pretty snazzy. However, over dinner, Revson told me he didn't like the outfit, yellow was not my best color, and he would be happy to take me shopping. I thought he was out of his mind and told him so. Obviously, that didn't bother him one bit, because he asked me out the next night, told me his yacht was going to the south of France, and he would like me to join his friends on a cruise. I told him I was going to Washington the next day to cover the impeachment hearings, and so could not have dinner. As for the cruise, thanks but no thanks, for in my mind I was planning to go back to Los Angeles to be with my friend Joyce and see more of Matt Byrne. I just wasn't interested in Charles Revson, millionaire or not. The next day, just as I was leaving my apartment for the plane to Washington, an enormous bouquet of roses arrived from him. There must have been 6 dozen long-stemmed roses, all wrapped in tissue paper. What to do? Nobody was home in my apartment. Dump them? All those roses? Nothing like that had ever happened to me before, so like a fool, I carried them along with my suitcase on the airplane, balancing them on my lap, jabbing the person in the seat next to mine, and schlepping them all the way to my hotel in Washington. I never did see Charles Revson again. What I hadn't known on that one summer date in 1974 was that he was suffering from cancer. I always wondered if that was why he so unceremoniously decided to leave his wife. Shades of Frank McGee. He died the following summer at the age of 68. These were just some of the various men in my life during the early and middle 70s. Which brings me to the more important part. There were, during those years, 3 men who were, then or later, extremely well known. They were all distinguished and accomplished. What they had in common was that they were all in government. That's not really a surprise. After all, people in government were the ones with whom I was most often in contact. Other than that, they were very different. They did, however, have one thing in common. I cared about each of them very much. Special men in my life. Edward W. Brooke was the first African-American elected to the U.S. Senate since Reconstruction. He served two terms from 1967 to 1979. He was a Republican from the mostly Democratic state of Massachusetts, so he clearly did not fit a senator's traditional profile. Before going to Washington, he had served two terms as that state's very popular attorney general, and then he had run for the Senate at a time when few people expected a black man could be elected to that all-white, very exclusive club. He won, and in the Republican Party, he became a star. One magazine of the time described him as a model of how blacks could rise through the whole white-dominated ranks of mainstream politics. There was some thought that he might be the first African-American nominated to run as vice president, or could even rise as high as running for president. A most distinguished man. Anyone can find this information easily. What they will not find, and what only my closest friends knew, is that Senator Edward W. Brooke and I had a long and rocky affair. Oh yes, he was also married. Where do I begin? Where did the affair begin? It was 1973. I certainly wasn't lacking for men in my life or for romance. I was dating more than I ever had. Why, therefore, did I have a clandestine affair with a married man? A black married man. Though racial tolerance was on the rise, interracial marriages more than doubled in the 1970s, having a romance with a married black senator would have raised more than eyebrows. I had a daughter to think about and a network that would be less than thrilled to see me involved in any kind of scandal. None of that seemed to matter to me. Ed Brooke was simply the most attractive, sexiest, funniest, charming, and impossible man. I was excited, fascinated, intrigued, and infatuated. We met first in New York at a restaurant. I was with friends, he was with friends. We were introduced. He shook my hand and smiled. He had a big, wicked smile, more of a grin. Now just who is this, I remember thinking. Months later, I was in Washington. We were doing some kind of a panel on Nixon and China, and Senator Brooke was booked on the panel. He asked if I was staying in town that day. I said I was. He asked if he could take me to lunch. I said sure. He took me to the Senate dining room, where guests were often invited. Perfectly innocent, and despite a serious expression to fool all onlookers, he flirted excessively. He told me that he had never stopped thinking of me since the night we met. Really? He told me that he watched me every morning. No kidding. He told me that he was married to an Italian woman who was white and that he had met her in Italy when he served in the army, segregated in those days, during World War II. After the war, he came home and sent for her, his young war bride. She spoke no English. Even now, Brooke said, after almost 30 years of marriage and life in America, she had barely learned English. He said sadly that after the novelty of their relationship wore off, they had little in common except their two daughters, by then almost adults. He rarely saw his wife except on holidays or when he was campaigning. She was, he admitted, a very good campaigner, especially among the large Italian-American population in Greater Boston. It was a marriage that had long ago run its course, but politicians didn't get divorced in those days, and besides, his wife was used to his absences and never questioned him. Why divorce? It is very difficult to explain to anyone else why you are attracted to someone. It certainly wasn't because Brooke, I never called him Ed, catered to me or flattered me, or maybe it was precisely because he didn't do either. I had always liked men who were kind to me. I was not a masochist. But Brooke played with me. He was hard to reach, hard to pin down. I found it both funny and frustrating. After the initial compliments, Brooke often joked, and sometimes I thought wasn't really joking, that I was the oldest woman he had ever been attracted to. I was in my early 40s. He was 10 years older. But age didn't seem to touch him. He had been attracting women most of his life. Sometimes when he said that I was the oldest woman he had ever been with, I thought of telling him, "Oh yeah, well you are the blackest man I have ever been with." But the truth is, it didn't matter. Not that I was blinded to the fact that if our romance became public, his color wouldn't matter. But Brooke being black just didn't seem important one way or the other. It was also something we never discussed. Looking back, maybe that was strange. I remember thinking that Brooke, who was light-skinned, didn't truly consider himself black. He never talked about his background or any problems black people might have. If he had felt discrimination, and he must have, he never mentioned it. Part of the attraction was that Brooke wanted to be in control. I wasn't used to that, and at first it was pleasing to me. But then, he would try to control me in ways that made no sense except to prove that he could. For example, we once made plans to be together in New York. I sent Jackie to stay at Shirley's. My cousin hated the whole idea of Brooke but loved Jackie and was happy to have her sleep over. Jackie also found a night away from Mommy very adventurous. Zell and Icodel, who were at home, loved me and protected me with their silence. Dinner was cooked, music was playing. And then Brooke phoned to say he had decided not to leave Washington. No excuse. In one way, I was relieved. I had felt so guilty sending Jackie away for the night. On the other hand, I was furious, and for a week or so refused Brooke's phone calls. But then I gave in, and began to see him again. Why on earth? The simple answer was that he excited me. There was one couple who knew about us, old friends of Brooke's. They had a home in Virginia. Sometimes we stayed there. Sometimes we stayed in Brooke's apartment at the Watergate. We were very careful, and besides, we didn't see each other all that much. I lived and worked in New York, he lived and worked in Washington, and most important, I didn't want to be away from Jackie unless I truly had to. Summer was a different matter. Brooke had a big house in Oak Bluffs, an elegant section of Martha's Vineyard that, then and now, caters mostly to upper-class, affluent African-Americans. My close friends from Washington, Anne and Vernon Jordan, also have a house in Oak Bluffs. I always thought Vernon suspected something, but if he did, he was too much of a gentleman to say. I visited Brooke there one weekend. I met his mother. His father was dead. A most charming woman who adored her accomplished son. God knows what she thought of me, but she was cordial. Her son could do no wrong. The next summer, with 3 weeks off from the Today Show, I took a house myself in a different part of the vineyard. I asked Shirley to stay with me, and she brought her granddaughter, who was the same age as Jackie. We were very private. Brooke visited us 2 or 3 times a week. Jackie still vaguely remembers him. She rarely saw him on his visits to me in New York. She sort of liked him, but not a lot. He once gave her a present with a note typed on U.S. Senate stationery, her name spelled wrong. The note was dated November 14, 1974. It said, "Dear Jackie," J-A-C-Q-U-I-E, "here's Raggedy Ann to be your friend, and now you will have company for dinner every night." It was signed, "Love, Mr. B." I wonder now if his secretary typed the note. I wonder, too, when he said that Jackie would have company for dinner, if it was because he wanted me to have dinner with him alone. I was still seeing other men in a more or less casual way. One was the very kind and gentle John Diebold, whom I've already told you about, and who was as different from Ed Brooke as day and night. He was so thoughtful and dependable. When I wasn't seeing Brooke, I was most often with John. I used to sing a song by Rodgers and Hart that began, "He was too good to me," because it reminded me so of John, who, of course, never knew about Brooke. In spite of these complications, my relationship with Brooke grew. Politics was his passion and my great interest. We never ran out of things to talk about, and of course, there was the fascination of our having to be so secretive, forbidden fruit and all that. But I was beginning to resent the sneaking around, and I slowly began asking myself if we could ever be married. Would such a marriage destroy his career? Would it destroy mine? We would never know if we couldn't have a public relationship. By this time, things were getting serious. That Thanksgiving, when we had been seeing each other for almost 2 years, Brooke didn't go home. Instead, he stayed in New York with me. He was planning to spend part of the Christmas holiday with me, too. His wife, who had condoned his romances for many years, now suspected that something different was happening. Washington, at least some people in Washington, also began to suspect that the senator and I had more than a professional relationship. We would occasionally be at the same reception or dinner. We deliberately sought out these parties to which we had both been invited. At these occasions, purposely out loud, Brooke would ask if he could take me home. People were noticing. There was, at that time, a tough and shrewd gossip columnist for the Washington Post named Maxine Cheshire. Everyone feared her, as did I, especially when she began to write blind items about Brooke and me seeing each other. Things had to change. I told Brooke that I could no longer live like this. He was married. It had to end. But Brooke was not having just another flirtation. Our relationship had all but reached the point of no return. So he did something neither he nor I had ever imagined he would do. It was something that would put his whole political career in jeopardy. He went home and asked his wife for a divorce. She was furious. I don't blame her. Not that she would actually miss her husband, as he was so rarely home, but she was, after all, Mrs. Edward W. Brooke, a very important woman. She was also the mother of their two daughters. And though she may not have spoken English well, she sure spoke her own language well. The Italian voters would be unforgiving. She fought back. With inquiries, perhaps to his staff, she found out that I was the woman for whom her husband wanted a divorce. She hired detectives. She knew someone who worked for the tabloid National Enquirer. The paper loved the story and assigned its own investigator. Brooke, at that time, owned a vacation house on the Caribbean island of St. Martin. He often went there on vacation, sometimes with a guest. Could I have been such a guest? The National Enquirer reporter, I heard, was roaming the island with photographs of me, hoping a storekeeper or a restaurant waiter would recognize me. I had never been there with Brooke, but their search went on. I was getting very nervous. Around this time, I received a phone call from a very good friend, Pete Peterson, who had been Secretary of Commerce under Richard Nixon. I trusted Pete and knew he had my best interests at heart. With some embarrassment and pain, he told me that he had heard of my relationship with Ed Brooke and he felt the story would soon burst into the public. It would all but ruin my career, he said. NBC might have trouble standing by me. My divorce from Lee had been very quiet and dignified, and my reputation was solid and above board. Pete thought I had better seriously examine what the ramifications of continuing my relationship with Ed Brooke might be. I did. So did Brooke. He could not afford to risk his career. He was proud of being in the Senate, and his future could only get better. I also could not risk my career. I had a child and my family in Florida to think about. We decided wisely, but very sadly, that we had to stop seeing each other. That was that. We stopped. I missed him terribly at first. He had been so much a part of my life and my fantasies. However, the truth is that after the years of hiding, it was also a relief. But by this time, Brooke had burned his bridges with his wife. He decided he still wanted the divorce and hoped that a divorce with no recriminations would not affect his Senate seat. But that was the trouble. The divorce became very acrimonious, and there were recriminations. His wife's fury led to stories in the newspapers about his private life. This led to an investigation into the financial affairs between him and his mother-in-law, then living in Boston in a nursing home. Brooke was accused of improperly transferring funds from his mother-in-law's account so that Medicaid would pay her nursing home bills. He claimed it was an honest bookkeeping error, and he was never convicted of anything. But it undermined his reputation. In the middle of it all, Brooke ran for re-election. He lost the election, and his promising political career ended. It was by then 1978, and even though it had been several years since we had seen each other, a part of me always felt it was my fault. I still feel that way. Maybe I'm giving myself too much credit or perhaps too much blame, but before me, no matter how many romances or affairs Brooke had had, he never sought a divorce. His asking for one and his wife's anger led to his political downfall. But his life went on. He married a beautiful African-American woman. They had a son, who by now must be a young man. In 2004, President George W. Bush awarded Brooke the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Happy news. Not such happy news was the story I read about him in 2003 in the New York Times. He had breast cancer and had undergone a double mastectomy. He had gone public with the news, he said, because he wanted other men to be aware that breast cancer, though extremely rare, could happen to men. It was very brave of him. The article gave his age as 83. I thought of writing to him to say how courageous he was, but I decided not to. Our relationship seemed so long ago. For a time, however, it was a very important one in my life. That is why I am writing about it now. Now about two of the other men who meant so much to me at the time. I met Alan Greenspan in 1975 at a tea dance in Washington, hosted by Vice President Nelson Rockefeller. In these days of concrete barricades and multiple security checks at government buildings, it's hard to believe the Vice President of the United States was having a dance. Well, actually, he was, and as a matter of fact, Vice President Rockefeller and his wife Happy hosted several such dancing housewarmings at Admiral's House, the newly renovated official residence for vice presidents and their families on Embassy Row. The invitation list for the different parties included movie stars, Cary Grant, astronauts, Alan Shepard, businessmen, publisher William Randolph Hearst, members of the press, me, and political appointees, Alan. It also included the Rockefellers' friends and members of Congress. In fact, the Rockefellers had their own house in Washington and weren't planning to move into the 82-year-old Admiral's house, but were using the official residence to meet and greet. The residence had a particular attraction because of the important pieces of art the Vice President had donated from his personal collection. The centerpiece was the famous cage bed in the master bedroom, designed by the surrealist artist Max Ernst. It was covered in mink, watched over at the head and foot by medallions of the sun and moon, and had trap doors to hide lamps, telephones, and electrical gadgets. No one slept in it, but everyone who visited the mansion wanted to see it. Then we would mill around on the spacious grounds for refreshments as a small orchestra played. There was a little dance floor, and some people danced. At one of these housewarmings, a tall, bespectacled man approached me and asked if I wanted to dance. His name was Alan Greenspan, he told me, and he was the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers for President Ford. Sounded important, if rather dull to me. But Chairman Greenspan was very pleasant and unassuming. After we danced, and by the way, he was a very nice dancer, he told me that he actually lived in New York on weekends and asked if he could call me. I gave him my phone number, and indeed, the next weekend, he phoned. I was just coming out of the relationship with Ed Brooke, and I welcomed this call, the first of many, from the tall, quiet stranger. I had a little problem, which was actually kind of fun. As I have written, I had been going out off and on for many years with the investment banker Alan Greenberg, and I continued to see him from time to time, even during the Brooke years. So when Alan Greenspan would call the house, he sometimes left only his first name. When Alan Greenberg called the house, he too often left just his first name. This was very confusing to Zell and Ikodel. Even if they asked either gentleman to please leave his last name, it was not much help. Greenberg, Greenspan, they sounded so much alike that both ladies were in despair. When they gave me the message, I could only ask, which one talked louder? Alan Greenberg was blunt, jovial, and outgoing. He talked in a normal tone of voice, Alan Greenspan, on the other hand, was very soft-spoken. He almost whispered. And that's how I would know whether it was Greenspan or Greenberg. In the years ahead, when Alan Greenspan was the immensely influential chairman of the Federal Reserve and testifying before Congress, I never heard him raise his voice. He certainly never did with me. Part of it is just the lovely nature of the man. Part of it is an innate reticence. When we first began to see each other, I would often take him to a dinner party. He rarely mingled before dinner, and if he was seated next to a woman he didn't know, it was hard going for her because he was difficult to draw out. He is, by his own admission, an introvert, but even so, he has also said he enjoys social events. He was not the sort of man you would notice when he walked into the room, and often I would have to introduce him to friends more than once because they wouldn't remember him. Perhaps because of his shyness, he walked a bit bent over as if not to attract attention. It wasn't insecurity, it was modesty. Even now, in spite of his great fame, Alan still has that quality. I am now going to quote some of what Alan wrote in those times in his candid, best-selling autobiography of 2007, The Age of Turbulence. He remembers many more details than I do. Here are some of Alan's words. I am not threatened by a powerful woman. In fact, I'm now married to one. The most boring activity I could imagine was going out with a vacuous date. Before getting to know Barbara, a typical evening for me would be a professional dinner with other economists. Barbara, however, interacted constantly with news, sports, media, and entertainment personalities. During the years we dated, and afterward, we remained good friends, I escorted Barbara to lots of parties where I met people I otherwise would never have encountered. I usually thought the food was good, but the conversation dull. They probably thought the same about me. Even so, I did build up a wonderful circle of friends. Barbara threw me a 50th birthday party. The guests were people I'd come to think of as my New York friends. Henry and Nancy Kissinger, Oscar and Annette De La Renta, Felix and Liz Rohedon, Punch and Carol Sulzberger, Henry and Louise Grunwald, and David Rockefeller. I am still friendly with many of these people today, more than 30 years later. Alan also wrote of my introducing him to friends of mine in Los Angeles, where he would tag along with me to parties, even though he felt totally out of place. Business economists are not exactly party animals, he wrote. Today, those people who are still friends of his and mine probably brag about having met Alan all those years ago. I didn't know a thing about economics. I didn't have to. Alan and I would discuss the news of the day. We would talk politics, although he was always very careful not to tell me anything I shouldn't know. We would go to the theater or occasionally to concerts. Alan had a fascinating background. We had all read Ayn Rand's The Fountainhead with its mysterious and independent hero architect, Howard Roark. The message of The Fountainhead was that laissez-faire capitalism was everything, that government should stay out of all things, and that charity was poison. Ayn Rand was perhaps the most passionate and controversial advocate of free enterprise you could find, and she had a small but devoted and influential following. They called themselves objectivists. Alan was still a follower of Ayn Rand in those days. He encouraged me to read her other most famous book, Atlas Shrugged, which I did. Neither book had a great influence on me, but I do remember wishing that my parents had thought to call me Dagny, the name of Ayn Rand's beautiful capitalist heroine. How Alan Greenspan, a man who believed in the philosophy of little government interference and few rules or regulations, could end up becoming chairman of the greatest regulatory agency in the country is beyond me. It was a big issue when Alan was first appointed, but he was so brilliant at this job that the Ayn Rand relationship faded from conversation. Alan, to my great surprise, had been a musician before becoming an economist. He had studied the clarinet at the Juilliard School of Music in New York, and for a time played with the Henry Jerome Band in New York, along with Len Garment, Nixon's future White House counsel, on saxophone. They became friends, and it is said that Garment later recommended Alan for the job as chair of the Council of Economic Advisers, which is when I met him. Through Alan, I remember meeting a very pleasant Dick Cheney, who was then White House Chief of Staff to President Ford. I also met Donald Rumsfeld, Ford's defense secretary. Nice men, I thought. Interesting, though unexciting. We occasionally had dinner with them and their wives, evenings that were not noteworthy. I met them again years later, when George W. Bush was president. They seemed like very different men to me. They also didn't seem to remember that we had known each other. I requested interviews with each of them and was turned down. Back when Alan and I had a relationship, he lived in Washington during the week and kept a small apartment in New York near the United Nations. His mother, to whom he was devoted, came over every weekend to bring him food and make sure that a housekeeper had come to tidy up. Alan's parents had divorced when he was very young, and he rarely mentioned his father. He was raised by his grandmother and mother, both of whom worked. I liked his mother very much. She was warm, lively, and, unlike her son, an extrovert. She loved to play the piano, and as I had a piano in my apartment, she often played for us when she visited. Years later, when Alan was chairman of the Federal Reserve and living full-time in Washington, he would come to New York every week to see his mother. We would sometimes have lunch after he visited her. I admired this devotion to his mother very much. When he was in his 20s, Alan had been married for a short time to a woman who, I think, was also part of the Ayn Rand group. The marriage ended in divorce, and he had long been a bachelor with, it seemed, little desire to remarry. As I, too, had no real desire to remarry, the subject never came up. Furthermore, I never heard Alan express a desire to have children. He was sweet to my daughter, but had no real relationship with her. Since I didn't think of him as a prospective stepfather, that was okay with me. I felt calm and secure being with Alan. The same qualities that made him so admired in Washington were present on a personal level. He was so smart, so knowledgeable, and had little of the dominating ego that many powerful men possess. Although I rarely understood what he was talking about when he testified before Congress, I had no problem understanding him when we were together. He never talked down to me. He could and did listen to my worries and complaints for hours and never talked to me about his own. He never criticized. He had a surprisingly wry sense of humor. He was, in short, the nicest person you could meet. If I had any reservation, it was that Alan was very frugal, not just with me, but with himself. He wore the same navy blue raincoat until it practically fell apart. He was a bit like the classic absent-minded professor. He rarely remembered to pick up a check or buy a Christmas or birthday gift, but that is the only small failing I can recall. After Jimmy Carter defeated Gerald Ford in the 1976 presidential election, Alan left government to return to the economic consulting firm he had founded called Townsend Greenspan. I never did find out who Townsend was. People often asked Alan for advice on buying or selling stocks or bonds. He politely brushed them off. That was not his area of expertise. His mind, so keen, was best at examining long-term trends and financial conditions that would influence all elements of society. In future years, we often laughed about the one time I asked him for financial advice. After we had been seeing each other for a few years, I decided to leave my rent-controlled apartment and buy a co-op. Shirley found a beautiful one for me in the same building that Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis lived in. It had four bedrooms, a huge living room and dining room, and it faced Central Park. It was 1977, and New York City was facing a financial crisis. There were even concerns that the city might be going bankrupt. The seller was asking $250,000, which seemed pretty fair for a big, beautiful apartment on Fifth Avenue. I asked Alan's advice. "Don't buy it," he said. "The way New York City is going, it's not a good investment." So I didn't buy it. Today, that apartment is worth at least $30 million. Alan and I never actually broke up, but when a relationship doesn't grow, it gradually diminishes. We didn't want to marry, and in those days we couldn't live together. Still, I was shortly to be going through a very turbulent time professionally. Alan, it should be noted, was at my side throughout that time, and I don't know how I would have gotten through it all without his wisdom and support. You will hear more about that later. Although it was some 30 years ago, my essential feelings about Alan Greenspan have never changed. He is one of the finest people I know. Eventually, I fell in love and married someone else. Alan met and fell in love with the wonderful NBC correspondent, Andrea Mitchell, another strong woman. Andrea is a great reporter, and she and Alan have much in common. Alan finally got over his marriage phobia. I was so pleased to have been invited to Alan and Andrea's wedding in 1997. It is the happiest of unions. They adore each other, and I adore being in their company. I am proud to be their friend. In the fall of 2007, I joined some friends of Alan's in giving him a book party. The book, by the way, is a fascinating read about his 18 years as chairman of the Federal Reserve and his own life journey, including me and those boring dinner parties. When you finish this book, and I hope you will, do read Alan's. And finally, some words about John Warner, one of the finest and most effective senators in Congress, who at this writing is serving his fifth consecutive term as the senior senator from Virginia. I also met John in the early 70s, years before he became a senator. He was then the head of the Bicentennial Commission, preparing to celebrate 200 years of America's independence. Gerald Ford had appointed him to this federal position after several others had failed to do very much with the job. Actually, there wasn't really a great deal of heavy lifting to do. It was mostly making sure that all the states were going to contribute something to the celebration. John took the job very seriously and committed himself to visiting all 50 states. As the spokesman for the Bicentennial, he appeared on the Today Show, and I was assigned to interview him. He remembered me, he later said, as brisk and attractive. I remember him as having great hair and being rather pompous. Still, when he asked if I would have lunch, I said okay. He talked a lot about himself and his plans for the Bicentennial. I liked his southern manners. He was definitely from the old school. I asked around about him, and this is what I learned. John was one of two sons of a doctor in Virginia whom John adored and was close to his entire life. John had finished law school at the University of Virginia after serving with the Marines in Korea and cut quite a swath as an eligible young lawyer at the various Virginia debutante balls. In 1957, he married Catherine Conover Mellon, the only daughter of Paul Mellon, one of the richest men in the world. The Mellon money came from Paul's father, Andrew, who had helped found such companies as Alcoa and the Gulf Oil Corporation. John was an advance man for Richard Nixon when Nixon was campaigning for president. In 1972, Nixon appointed John to be Secretary of the Navy. John was secretary from 1972 until 1974, and that's when he was appointed to head the Bicentennial celebration. In the meantime, John and Catherine had three children, two girls and a boy. But Catherine was young and, I gather, didn't enjoy John's way of life. She was more artistic and sought a lower key and simpler style. The marriage ended in divorce in 1973, and for many years John pretty much raised their children. Paul Mellon had given his daughter and son-in-law a magnificent home in the fashionable Georgetown section of Washington and a huge farm in the horse country in Virginia. In the divorce agreement, Paul Mellon gave them both to John, I guess because he was such a good and responsible father. I remember asking John, when he first talked about the farm, how big it was. I had no idea how large farms were supposed to be, but I knew enough to be staggered when he told me it was almost 3,000 acres. It had horses, cows, a tennis court, an indoor swimming pool, and a state-of-the-art kitchen. When I got to know John better, he invited me to visit, along with Jackie and Ecodel. We passed acres and acres of corn, which Jackie had never seen growing. We then made ice cream in the kitchen, which had every possible piece of cooking equipment you could want. The house was only partially decorated. John had a splendid study with a fireplace and a huge desk. Upstairs, the master bedroom also had a fireplace and was decorated in a lovely paisley. The interior designer was Billy Baldwin, one of the most famous decorators in America. But John had stopped work on the house when he and Catherine separated. Anyway, that's how things were when John Warner and I met. He talked of wanting to run for senator from Virginia, but he didn't seem to have much backing from the Republican Party. He also knew few journalists. I remember taking him to a birthday party for the Washington Post's executive editor, Ben Bradley, and introducing him to many of my friends. Although they found him very pleasant, he wasn't exactly their sort, or, at that time, mine. But we grew closer. When the Today Show went to Hawaii, John arranged to be there too. I was surprised and pleased by his attention. I had brought Jackie, and John arranged for us to have a special tour of Pearl Harbor and to visit a submarine. We had a fascinating time, and even little Jackie was excited. I appreciated John's kindness, but our relationship was winding down. It drew to a close in 1976 when John was invited to the White House to be the escort of no less a superstar than Elizabeth Taylor. Knowing them both, I could not imagine a less well-suited pair, but each had a fantasy. Elizabeth's career was on the rocks and she was seeing a series of not very appealing men. Then along came this knight in shining armor, independently wealthy, handsome. Did I neglect to tell you that he was very handsome? And I think, most important, there was his fabulous farm. Elizabeth loved horses, and perhaps she thought herself back in the days of her childhood when she first appeared in the film National Velvet, a classic story about the love of a child for her horse. The film made the exquisite girl a star, and Elizabeth had not known a day since when she was not famous. So now, at last, a farm, peace, security. She and John were married in a field at the farm on December 4, 1976. Elizabeth, in photographs, with the cows and horses in the background, is a symphony of rustic elegance. She's wearing a lavender gray dress, a lavender turban, gray suede boots, and a silver fox coat, and is holding a bouquet of heather. The marriage gave John instant fame, in spite of the fact that this was his new wife's seventh marriage, counting both of her marriages to the British actor Richard Burton. For a moment or two, John considered an acting career himself. He even had a screen test. But what he really wanted to be was a senator from Virginia. He finished second in the Republican primary in 1978 to a young up-and-coming politician named Richard Obenshain. When Obenshain was tragically killed in a private plane crash just a few weeks later, John was tapped to be the candidate. The Republicans couldn't have made a better choice. With his celebrated wife at his side, John traveled the state of Virginia from one end to the other. Elizabeth introduced him and shook so many hands that she later complained that she got ulcers of the hands. John made the political speeches, but it really didn't matter what he said. Everybody wanted to meet his famous wife. In November, John was elected to the Senate and soon became one of the hardest-working and most conscientious politicians in Congress. That was a problem for Elizabeth. Being the wife of a senator is not a lot of fun. She hated the long, boring dinners. She missed her friends. Elizabeth Taylor has a great, slightly ribald sense of humor, and there were not a lot of people who appreciated it, including, I think, her husband. I remember going to their farm for a rather bizarre interview with them, my second primetime special for ABC, just before John was elected to the Senate. Here was my former boyfriend, with a pipe in his mouth, talking about his partner, Elizabeth, and how they were in all this day in and day out together. But later, talking with them both in the kitchen, I remembered so well. It seemed that what Elizabeth was doing most, day in and day out, was eating. John said she should eat more vegetables. "I do eat vegetables," Elizabeth replied. "Potatoes." Although she claimed that she was very happy, the marriage was obviously doomed, and they were divorced 6 years later in 1982. Sometime later, in yet another interview with me, she confessed that she had been unhappy in the marriage, and that is why she ate. but her respect and affection for John remained. So did mine. I hate to keep using the word kind to describe this man or that, but John Warner was one of the kindest people you could find. He was a gentleman, honest and caring. I watched with pride as he became more and more effective in the Senate. I myself, in spite of my earlier vow never to marry, had another marriage, and after that divorce in 1990, John and I began to see each other again, this time quite seriously. That was when I really got to know him. I admired his complete devotion to his job. He was a staunch Republican, but he didn't just follow the party line. He became a maverick in 1993 when he refused to support Mike Farris, the Republicans' nominee for lieutenant governor of Virginia, because he felt he was too controlled by the Christian right. Farris lost. John took on the Republican hierarchy again in 1994, when he actively campaigned against Oliver North, another born-again and controversial figure, who was the Republican nominee for Virginia's other Senate seat. John disliked North so much that he supported a popular state politician who was running against him as an independent. The result of John's political maneuverings was that the Republicans lost the Senate seat. It was won by the Democratic incumbent, Senator Chuck Robb. John's stature was not diminished. He became chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee in 1999 and served in that capacity with a short break until the Democrats gained control of the Senate in 2006. John and I saw each other for about 5 years in the 1990s. He spent many weekends with me during summers in Southampton. My friends became his friends, and they enjoyed him thoroughly. He loves to play tennis and golf and had many spirited games with Pete Peterson and Rune Arledge, both of whom had homes in the Hamptons. Most of all, John loved to paint. I can still picture him sitting in the shade of a tree in my backyard, doing his oil paintings of flowers. Flowers are John's specialty. They are the cover of his Christmas card each year. Again, however, it has to be said that a relationship that doesn't grow begins to diminish. I could never imagine myself as the wife of a senator living in Washington, and New York life was never really for John. We talked all the time but saw each other less and less. Eventually, he met a nice woman, Jean Vandermeide, who lives in Washington and shared his interests. They were married in 2003, and when I talk with John, I can tell how happy he is. It is especially important for John to have the companionship and satisfactions he now has. In August 2007, at the age of 80, John announced that he would not seek re-election to the Senate. He would leave at the height of his power, admired and respected. John continually proved himself a true leader. He was among the first in his party to call on President Bush to reduce the troops in Iraq. He did this although he respects the president and would not want to hurt his own party. He has come such a long way from the man who had originally been known primarily as the husband of Elizabeth Taylor. I think he will be truly missed in the Senate. Shortly after John announced his resignation, he telephoned me and we had a long, happy conversation. He had always phoned me on the nights when he was re-elected to the Senate. This now was a phone call of affection between two dear friends. I told John that I would miss that call on election night, but I thought he had done the right thing. He will leave at the top. Whenever I think of John, I see him, as I do Alan Greenspan and Ed Brooke, as such a very special man. I consider myself so fortunate to know them. And now that you know about my late-blooming, delayed love life, it's time to get back to work. Egypt, Israel, and Hola, Castro. Co-host. A very satisfying title after 10 years of sitting beside the male host on the morning desk at Today. 10 years. Seems small by today's standards, but in 1974, a breakthrough. The title did not translate to anything else. I didn't get a raise or a bigger office or more say over the program, but the media took note. Newsweek even considered the new title to be worthy of a cover story. Barbara Walters, Star of the Morning. I loved the line that described the questions I asked as some of the toughest in television journalism. Dum-Dum Bullets Swaddled in Angora. The real and only difference in my life was that Frank McGee was gone, and so was all the off-camera tension and acrimony. I could interview anyone I wanted to in the New York studio and ask all the questions, which I didn't, of course. Jim Hartz and I worked as a very sharing team. There was another departure from today, Frank Blair, the program's newscaster for 21 years. I can't say I was terribly sorry to see him go. He was drinking a lot by then and had become rather sour. He also had quite a reputation. Frank was a handsome man, and though long married, he bragged about chasing every woman on the show, including me. He was the only one on the program, in today's parlance, who hit on me. But that had been years before, and we'd had a cordial truce ever since. A very pleasant fellow named Lou Wood replaced Frank, and the Today team became Jim Hartz, Gene Shalit, Lou, and me. I was still spending a lot of time in Washington, and it was proving to be helpful. Among the many ambassadors I met and became friendly with at the various embassy parties was the Egyptian ambassador Ashraf Gorbal. He was intelligent and charming, as was his wife Amal Amer, and I spent many pleasurable evenings with them. 4 years later, Ambassador Gorbal would play a vital role in the Camp David peace accords between Egypt and Israel, but in 1974, there was no hint of peace between the two countries. Egypt and Israel had fought a bitter war in 1973, the war that had caught Israel by surprise and marked the downfall of my friend Moshe Dayan. A Middle East peace conference was scheduled to be held in Geneva, and there was an air of cautious optimism. Having spent a good deal of time with Israeli leaders, I was anxious to interview their Muslim counterpart and official enemy, Egyptian President Anwar el-Sadat. I expressed that interest to Ambassador Gorbal, who passed it on to the Egyptian Foreign Minister, Ismail Fahmy, when he visited Washington in the summer of 1974. Through Ambassador Gorbal, I managed to get an interview with the Foreign Minister, who would later resign, rather than accompany Sadat on his historic journey for peace to Jerusalem. He too was cordial, and after our interview, listened attentively to my request for his assistance in securing an interview with President Sadat. Americans don't know President Sadat at all, and as a result, they fear him and they fear your country, I told the minister. If your president is considering doing any interview, he would have no better forum than the Today Show. Please ask him if I can come to Cairo to speak with him. Let me introduce him to the American people. Several weeks later, to my great pleasure, as Sadat had given no interviews to the American press, I got the green light. Well, half a green light. I would be welcome in Egypt, Ambassador Gorbal told me, but President Sadat had not committed to the interview. The indication was that I'd get the interview if Sadat liked me. I left as soon as I could for Cairo with a secret plan. I liked the Egyptians I'd met in Washington. I liked the Israelis I'd met in Israel and in Washington. To me, they seemed in many ways very similar, strong, intelligent, and proud people. Yet because their two countries existed in a perpetual state of war, they couldn't even speak to each other. Egypt didn't recognize Israel's right to exist, so therefore the Israeli government didn't exist either. On the Egypt Air flight to Cairo, I saw that Israel did not even appear on the airline's map. So this was my plan. Assuming I got the interview with President Sadat, I then intended to fly to Israel to pose the same questions to the Israeli Prime Minister, Yitzhak Rabin. I was going to run both interviews on the same program. Not only would people now perhaps understand the differences between the two countries and their leaders, but the two men might even discover some areas of agreement. So what if I didn't win the Nobel Peace Prize? It would make good television. It didn't happen. I sat in my Cairo hotel room for several days, staring at the phone, willing it to ring. I'd already cleared my plan with Prime Minister Rabin, who was a very savvy politician, but there was silence from the Egyptians. To pass the time, I talked travel plans on the phone with my producer, who was staying in the same hotel. There were no flights from Egypt to that country that doesn't exist, so we would have to go via Cyprus or Athens, but it would be well worth it to secure the two interviews and run them back to back. Immediately after we hung up, the phone rang. "It cannot be done," said the Egyptian government official on the line. "If you intend to use an interview with President Sadat on the same hour or even on the same day as Rabin, you will not be allowed to speak with our president." How could the Egyptians have known my plans? Obviously, they had tapped my line. So much for Barbara Walters' peacemaker. I gave the official my word that I would not combine my interview with Sadat with any other interview, but I still wasn't cleared to see him. I would be interviewed the next day by one of his aides, the official told me. Then they would see. I played it safe. Trying to be sensitive to Muslim conservative taste, I dressed in a black jacket and an ankle-length black skirt that I had bought for the occasion. I had no idea who or what to expect when I arrived at the president's house in Giza. I was taken to a marble-floored reception room and served chai, delicious spiced tea, when the door opened and a beautiful woman walked in. She was dressed in a chic green pantsuit. "I am Jahan Sadat," she said. We talked for an hour, and I discovered what a remarkable woman Mrs. Anwar Sadat was and is. She was wearing the same pantsuit she had worn to the front lines to encourage the Egyptian troops during the 1973 war. No other wife of an Egyptian leader had ever done that, either wear pants or go to see the male troops. She had also enrolled at Cairo University, hoping to encourage other women to seek higher education, and was planning to take her exams on live television. In spite of fierce religious opposition, she was championing birth control to curb Egypt's runaway population crush. She was also spearheading the building of homes for the disabled and for orphans and advocating rights for women going through divorce. Sadat himself had been divorced, with children, when he met the 15-year-old schoolgirl who was soon to be his wife. To Jahan, born of an English mother and an Egyptian father, Sadat was a hero. An Egyptian nationalist and revolutionary, he had been imprisoned for his efforts to rid the country of its British colonialists and their puppet, the corrupt King Farouk. Jahan's family did not approve of their daughter's choice. Sadat was many years older than she, divorced and penniless, but the couple married anyway, and from what I could see, it was a marriage of respect and affection. Over the years, and over many more cups of chai, Jahan and I became lifelong friends. I admired her then and now, and I was cleared for the interview with her husband. Her approval was the one that he needed. There is an image that has stuck in my mind for more than 30 years. When I arrived for the interview, I noticed a slight, bemused man sitting on one of the empty boxes our television equipment had come in, puffing on a pipe and watching his sitting room being transformed by the crew setting up the cameras and microphones, monitors and lights. There were no security guards, aides, or secretaries around him. The president of Egypt was simply taking in the scene. Our interview, the first of many over the years, went well. Sadat repeated over and over that he wanted peace with Israel, the conditions being Israel's return of the land it had occupied since 1967 and the formation of a legitimate Palestinian state. "The core of the problem is Palestinian," he said. Most important, he answered the one question everyone wanted to know: would he consider meeting with Prime Minister Rabin? "It is impossible now, impossible. After 26 years of hard feelings, violence, wars, hatred, bitterness, suddenly we meet? This is not logical at all." The answer, however, did not sound entirely final, but rather as somewhat hopeful, because he had said impossible now. We parted on a warm note. "Barbara," he called me. Always those three syllables, with emphasis on the middle syllable, "Barbara." I can hear his voice now as I write this. Years later, after her husband's death, Mrs. Sadat told me that what she remembered best about her husband was his deep, booming voice. I had certainly not found Sadat to be the feared ogre so many expected. He was personable, candid, and totally charismatic. So much so that I was concerned he would overshadow Prime Minister Rabin, who, though brilliant, often came over in interviews as taciturn and humorless. But in our interview in Tel Aviv, Prime Minister Rabin turned out to be extremely talkative. He answered my questions and afterward asked many of his own. Rabin was extremely curious about Sadat, a man he had never met and indeed might never meet. What is he like? What did he say? What did you think of him? I was not presumptuous enough to think of myself as an official intermediary, but I couldn't help but be struck by the fact that as a reporter, I could speak to both men and, in effect, deliver the messages they could not relay in person. So I described Sadat's personality to Rabin and told him my impression that Sadat was a thoughtful and reasonable man. I also told him my feeling that Sadat was not ruling out a meeting, but was waiting until the time was right. Back in New York, the two interviews aired on Today on two successive days. Large portions of the interviews also ran on the evening news programs. It was the beginning of the fall television season in September, and they were very well received, especially the segments with Sadat. This was his introduction to the American people, and they were fascinated by the man who would later become an American hero for being the first Muslim leader to make peace with Israel. I was there for that, too, which I'll tell you about later. Sadly, I would also be in Cairo again for Sadat's funeral after he was assassinated in 1981 for making that peace. In 1975, morning television was having its own little war. Good Morning America made its debut on ABC in November. It was our first serious challenge at Today, but hardly a surprise. Some months before the kickoff of the program, I had been approached by an ABC board member to see if I might be interested in coming to ABC. It was my first contact with ABC, and at the time, seemed very unusual to me. The ABC board member was a friend, an older, very nice, and successful businessman named Jack Houseman. He and his wife, Ethel, had a daughter with cerebral palsy, and in the past they had tried to be helpful with my sister. They thought she might have enjoyed visiting and perhaps working in one of the sheltered workshops they ran for people with the neurological disorder. Jackie did visit, but felt it was not a place for her. Still, I appreciated their interest, and every year volunteered to host their telethon, which raised money to fund research for cerebral palsy.